Ladies and gentlemen, I have on the line the gentleman who hosted The Tonight Show, well, within the last couple of years, walks out in front of the camera and says, "Oh my gosh, a Holiday Inn key from Bloomington, Illinois." Steve Allen, how are you?
Fine, thanks, Ken. How are you today?
Fine. I understand the Holiday Inn got their key back, and they wanted to thank you for mailing it to them.
Well, I am very forgetful about certain kinds of things. I tend to end up with a lot of things in my pocket that I should have left someplace else.
You are so busy. I have to ask you, how in the world? You write faster than I read. You have a new book out. It's called More Funny People. In fact, I tried to set up an interview with you to talk about funny people, and before I knew it, this thing had been out, and now you're working on the third one, aren't you?
Yes, I'm about maybe 40 or 50% through one called Funny People, Volume 3. I guess I'll just keep writing them till I run out of funny people.
Have you written about your favorite so far, or how did you decide who to write about?
Well, some in the two books. Some are my personal favorites, a good many, in fact. But that really wasn't a conscious criterion. I just included people concerning whose comedy I had a lot of thoughts, a lot of ideas, something to say on the subject.
In the first book, and I thought this was remarkable, you talked about the Marx Brothers, and when you compare, say, the Marx Brothers to Laurel and Hardy, you put them on a lower keel.
Yes. However, clarify, you already know that I'm talking about the Marx Brothers, not about Groucho himself. Groucho was one of the true giants and a great wit and a personal friend of mine. And at a dinner table, there was really nobody funnier. But I was writing in this new book, More Funny People, a chapter on Laurel and Hardy. And in that, as in earlier observations, I make the point that the Marx Brothers really made only a few films. They were very funny. I'm not saying they were terrible. But they were basically doing vaudeville routines, and they were a little in that regard like Abbott and Costello, who worked out ways to do their stage routines in movies.
I think the Marx Brothers did coconuts and animal crackers that way, didn't they?
I think so, yeah. They had done them first, as I say, on the stage in vaudeville and other theatrical contexts. And it's good stuff. It's a lot funnier than some of the things we see today. But it just wasn't in the same class at all with Laurel and Hardy's achievements or Charlie Chaplin's achievements. Those were true film comedians.
You point out in the first book, Funny People, that some of the lines that Groucho delivered were only funny when Groucho did so.
Yes, or at least they would have seemed funnier, they did seem funnier coming from Groucho than they would have from Bob Hope or Jack Benny or Donald Duck or almost anyone else. That's true. Of course, that's true to a certain extent of much humor. You could take a whole paragraph or half a page or so from a Richard Pryor script, and if you gave it to Bob Hope, you just wouldn't understand it at all. So each man, each performer has his own style.
Are you able to find humor yourself? And you are one of the greatest comedians, I think, that people would list if they were to make a list. Do you find that when you get involved in so many other things, you've written serious books, you write music, you write poems, you write plays. By the way, Meeting of the Minds was one of the all-time great works, I think.
Oh, thank you.
Do you find that sometimes you have to turn on the comedy and turn off the comedy?
No, because that implies a conscious decision, and there is no willing, no deciding whatever to this separation of activities. It is true that of my 26 books, most of them have had nothing to do with humor. My novels have been serious, and the short stories have been serious, and the poetry and so forth, and some of the works on political and social questions. But I don't decide when I sit down at a typewriter or pick up a tape recorder, as I do in recent years, that I'm going to be serious, nor for that matter do I decide on other occasions that I'm going to be funny. It's all remarkably automatic. I do consciously get an idea. I mean, I may see something on television that outrages me, and I think, well, we ought to tell the world about that and, you know, take a position on that. And I might have originally a totally serious motive for undertaking the work, but after that I could approach it in either a comic vein or a serious vein, and that's the part that's always automatic.
When you're doing a talk show, though, and of course you were the one that initiated the idea of really going out into the audience and ad-libbing with the folks, do you have to constantly censor your thoughts? I suppose anything pops into your head.
Well, there's a certain... Yeah, it's the same mechanism, I think, that in any of us is just called conscience. A conscience can apply to what you do or it can apply to what you say. And I think we all do that all day long. You may get, you know, if you hit your thumb with a hammer, to use a purposely classic example, if you're in the room by yourself, you may say several very strong words, four-letter words, and calling upon God and hell and all that sort of thing. But if there were six little five-year-old girls in that room with you, you would censor yourself. You wouldn't say those very same things out of consideration of your audience, so to speak. So we all do that, and I do it as a comedian, too. This is not to say that every time somebody says something to me, I think of four dirty answers to it. In fact, I very rarely do. But once in a great while, I'll think of something that I just decide in the fraction of a second not to say.
The comedians today, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I was thinking again about Groucho. Groucho could say things that other people would have probably gotten a poke in the eye for.
Yes.
But he found it impossible to insult people after a while. They thought anything he said was hilarious.
Right.
But now comedians, in order to be outrageous, it seems like they have to keep going one step and one step. And it's almost impossible to shock audiences, isn't it?
Well, it depends on the comedians and depends on the audiences. Yes, it's almost impossible now.
We've heard it all, it seems like, maybe.
Shock the average audience at a comedy club. In other words, the average audience that would be in attendance, let's say, at a Richard Pryor concert, is, as your point's very well taken, probably pretty close to impossible to shock because they've heard all the words 87 ways, and they've heard every daring thing said about religion and race and sex and whatever. So they may still laugh, and some of the comedians who work in this way are very clever. Richard Pryor is absolutely brilliant. But not everybody who works in this way is brilliant, and a good many of them would be well advised to work cleaner and more responsibly.
Mm-hmm. But again, shock isn't the only way to get laughs. And you've listed the different ways, I think, from time to time.
Well, nobody ever really will know if the last one has ever been listed because people keep coming. You know, Andy Kaufman is making us laugh in ways that no professional ever did before in any event.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always possible to explore new ground.
And yet, everybody that we consider classic now, I suppose, got their ideas and were influenced by people before them.
Oh, yes. It's not possible to grow up, anywhere for that matter in the universe, even if they kept you in a sealed chamber. You would be influenced by the plastic walls or something, you know. You are not a totally self-made person. That is not even possible. First of all, you didn't make yourself in any sense to begin with, and secondly, you don't dictate all the circumstances that add up to your psychological environment. But it is true. In fact, I put the question to a lot of the old-timers, and now I'm doing it as I talk to some of the younger people, too. And no matter who you talk to, whether it's Bob Hope or Jack Benny on that level or some, you know, new 23-year-old comedian, if you just say everybody's influenced to who influenced you, they will always come up with several names of people that they admired. Oddly enough, it does not always follow that because you admire another entertainer or comedian, he has a great influence on your work. My personal favorite from the time I was about 14 to the present moment is Robert Benchley. But unfortunately, I can see very little influence in my work. I wish there were more. I was also influenced.
Let me ask you this, Steve. Is Robert Benchley's style of writing still as enjoyable?
Yes, it is. I believe so. If anybody who doubts that or wants to just check it out, go to a library or a bookstore and pick up Benchley's books and spend a few hours with it some evening, and you'll laugh aloud, I think, two or three times per page. And, in fact, there's one writer now who writes in the Benchley and S.J. Pearlman style, and that's Woody Allen, who is our best literary humorist of his generation.
Mm-hmm.
He's hysterically funny on paper.
I was going to say, I think Groucho on paper looked a little like Benchley, too, didn't he?
Well, Groucho, I think, was influenced by Benchley, and Groucho, quote, for a comedian, end quote, wrote well. He really wasn't a great writer. He was just a great spontaneous wit. But he was literate, and he was interested in serious questions, and he had a serious side. He was a very bright man, and a good dinner companion, and so forth. He wasn't just a dope from a poor neighborhood who knew nothing about the world. He had somehow educated himself. But it would not be correct to put him in Woody Allen's class as a writer. No, not at all. Whereas Woody Allen, I have, in a review I did of one of his books, I place him in the class with Benchley and Pearlman. And, of course, that can only be determined by anyone listening to us now by reading all three of those writers, and then they'll see what I mean.
But didn't Pearlman write for the Marx Brothers?
Yes, he did, yes.
Okay.
But the Marx Brothers didn't write for Pearlman.
Steve Allen is our guest this morning. Let me break for a commercial, and we'll be right back. Okay, let's pick it up again if you're ready. There are a number of people in this book, Abbott and Costello, Fred Allen, who I think is forgotten about somewhat because he didn't seem to make the transition into TV from radio like some of the other folks.
Yeah, that's true. I think people under the age of, say, 55 don't know a great deal about Fred Allen, and that's a pity, so I hope my chapter will help in that regard.
Jack Benny, John Belushi. Is this a fair question, Steve, but do you seem to, and I think you sort of summarize this at the end of the book, there seems to be some kind of a question that you may be able to draw. Are comedians unhappy people in real life?
I think as a loose generalization, there is something to that, yes. Now, the question then becomes, or at least should become, one of as specific content as possible. In other words, are comedians less happy than dentists or football coaches or congressmen? You have to break it into a series of 74 separate questions like that. But I think it probably could be argued that they are. However, the word unhappy may confuse the picture as much as clarify it. I think they are certainly more neurotic than non-comedians as a class. And we nevertheless appreciate their gifts, and the world pays them very well for their services, and the comedians are dear to every culture, and there are funny folks all over the world. But, yes, if your daughter came home and said she was marrying a comedian, you might consider saying, gosh, couldn't you find a nice insurance salesman, because comedians don't, for the most part, make terribly good husbands or fathers.
It's an awfully demanding job, and, of course, if the audience turns on you, and I guess that can happen to anybody if you're trying out some new material.
Well, yeah, you know, a patient can turn out a dentist. I mean, we're not too thrilled with our TV repairmen or automobile mechanics either. You know?
But other professions like that, I don't think you have that constant feeling of having to receive acceptance.
That's true, yes. Only one patient may criticize a dentist at a time, but 4,000 people can suddenly, as you say, turn on, Bob Hope or whoever, if his last three jokes were no good. So there is that element, and every entertainer knows that going in. In the case of a tap dance that isn't terribly good, you don't find out about it till the end of it, and you just get a little bit of applause. But comedians elicit a response called laughter, and you have to have that every few seconds after each joke or after each amusing point. And you don't always get it. And there is no such thing as a comedian who has not bombed on one occasion or another.
Mm-hmm.
They all have.
In fact, Stan Laurel, I think, was interviewed and asked that same question. He said, what makes people laugh? He said, I'm not even going to try to answer that question. He says, but I can tell you this. You can do a routine that you did the night before on one corner and just put them in the aisles, and the very next night do the same stuff in the same general locale in the city and not get a laugh.
Oh, yes, absolutely. That's something that all comedians, we find that out very early in our careers. And at first, we're totally puzzled by it because it can be, as Stan has suggested, your strongest stuff. I mean, there's no question this is the material any good. Usually, yeah, it's been good for the last 4 years. So the fact is that although it's been getting screams for 4 years, why is it that one night in Gary, Indiana, at 8:30 p.m., suddenly the whole routine just bombs totally? And the reason, believe it or not, has much more to do with the audience than with the performer. I'm assuming the performer isn't drunk or falling off the stage or has his fly open or something, but he's just doing his usual good job. Audiences have definite characters. I discovered that many years ago when I used to do a nightly radio comedy show in Los Angeles with... The show is different every night, but the warm-up was basically the same. You know, the little comedy routine before you go on the air. And some nights before the curtain even went up, the audience would be like on New Year's Eve. And other nights when I peeked out through the curtain, they looked like they had come for the reading of a will.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very tough to get laughs out of that second kind of an audience. That had nothing to do with me. It was all their problem, but it became my problem.
Have you experienced what they call flop sweat?
No, I've been very fortunate. I've never really died that way. I have, as I say, like all entertainers, gone through some rather painful evenings where, as we were saying, your best stuff, you know, instead of getting the usual 89s and 94s, it suddenly gets about a 12 and a 16. And that's not too much fun, but you're a pro and you go through the evening. But I have never really totally bombed out. I've been very lucky in that regard. But partly, I suppose, because I ad lib. And when I do run into the occasional half-asleep audience, I simply talk about that, and I make them laugh at themselves, somewhat in the way that you see Johnny Carson do when a joke bombs and he does a saber. You know?
Yeah, you have a piano you can turn to, and you do a fine job on that. You sing.
Yeah, that helps, too. I can play the vibes with Terry Gibbs or, you know, jump to something else. That reminds me of a horror story that John Biner, who I think is wonderfully funny, told one night on one of my shows. He was performing somewhere, and nothing was working. It was one of those disastrous nights. And he has something to fall back on, too. He's a marvelous impressionist and mimic and impersonator. So he said, all right, ladies and gentlemen, we'll try a little music now to give you my impression. And he did a series of impressions, and he opened with Johnny Mathis, which he does very well. Chances are, you know. And after about four bars, it was in a nightclub. Several folks at tables just got up and began to dance. They liked the music. While he was up there imitating Tony Bennett. Really, it's like something in a Mel Brooks movie. Great story.
It's time for us to break again for a commercial. Steve Allen is our guest. We're talking about more funny people, believe it or not. We'll be right back. Okay. One of my favorite comedians was Jack Benny. I think probably his timing was just said to be the best. And Irving Fine was his manager, and... You say Jack Benny really didn't write material, but he could recognize good material.
Yes, he had wonderful editorial judgment.
And yet he was wrong in some cases, too, wasn't he? I think Fine said that the best stuff, the best shows he ever did were with material that he said, hey, that's not going to work.
Yeah, very often this is true of comedians, I think, generally, especially those who depend either totally or almost totally on writers. Even those who are very good at judging things, such as Bob Hope and Jack Benny, are not perfect. I shouldn't have used the word impeccable, since that means without fault. But even the best, as I say, do make some errors, and it often comes up in a particular kind of situation. It used to come up a lot in Jackie Gleason's old shows, and it has to do with the fact that the writers have created something rather fresh and new, a new direction, a new departure, and the comedians, I guess, feel uncomfortable trying anything new. The writers have confidence in it. They wrote it, and they know it'll work, or they're pretty sure it'll work. But some of the comics are very often uneasy. And then if they go ahead and do it anyway because the producer or whoever talks them into it, they often are pleasantly surprised.
Mm-hmm. I had a question about Steve Martin. I don't know if you're a Steve Martin fan or not, but he got to have such a cult behind him that people knew exactly what was coming up, and yet they still enjoyed his performance.
Yes.
Even he wasn't doing anything new, and it wasn't really telegraphing a joke. It's just that they knew what was going to happen.
Well, that happens... depending on what you mean by that, that familiarity with comedians' material often happens with the comedians who have done comedy albums or who have done concerts in a particular area before. If you saw the guy's show 2 years before and you go back, he's probably doing pretty much the same thing. And especially if he's, as I say, put it on, an album form, it's very common that an audience... Now, you would think that would really be harmful to a comic.
You would, wouldn't you?
If he knows the jokes. Mm-hmm. But and it would be if the people didn't care much about him. They'd think, oh, what's the big deal? I heard that joke before. But if the people in the audience are almost all real big fans, they can't wait for you to get to that punchline they know about. They love it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like sometimes when I go out and, you know, people just actually yell at me from the seats, just say, schmuck, schmuck for us, just once, you know? So I say it and they break up, you know? Mm-hmm. It certainly doesn't surprise them, but it's just something they want to hear, something they're familiar with.
There again, I think... And it's hard to limit this conversation, but there again, back to Jack Benny, the older he got, the more he looked cheap, the more he looked like he might have those long pauses between...
Yeah, Jack was in that regard a little like a lovable cartoon character. He was like, you know, Mr. Magoo or Popeye or something, because he never played himself. There was a sense in which he did, in that he spoke in a naturalistic way. He didn't, pretend to be Polish or a Catholic priest or, you know, some other role altogether. But the character traits were not his traits at all. And therefore he was, as I say, a make-believe character and a very lovable one.
When you sit down and try to analyze some of the people, you do a wonderful job of, I think, capturing what most of us try to... remember when we think about some of these famous comedians. If you were to sit down today for somebody who's a struggling comedian, you have to figure out physically what you look like, what you sound like. It's a pretty safe bet that if you decided to go into show business someday and become a big star, your chances are pretty slim that you'd ever make it, I would think.
You mean for someone just starting out from scratch?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's true, but that's true in a sort of a statistical sense of success in any field, whether you're talking about, astrophysics or brain surgery or whatever. Only a few stars or superstars emerge, and then there are hundreds or thousands, depending on the field, who are in the professional category, but not generally heralded. There's a certain naturalness.
I'm glad you understood where I was going, because that was one of the most poorly worded questions I've ever come up with, I think.
there's a certain naturalness, as I was saying, to being funny. It's a little like being tall, but it's not totally like being tall. Either you're tall or you're not, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sense in which it's also true that either you're funny or you're not, but you can do something about your funniness, whereas you can't do much about your tallness. So, in fact, one of the books I'm working on at the moment is called How to Be Funny. Now, if anyone listening has always been told he's stuffy and totally unfunny, reading that book won't make him totally different. But most of us, I think, have, probably 98% of the American people, or the people on the world, have some kind of a sense of humor. We laugh at other people, or we tell a joke at the office, or, we giggle when we, or our pants fall down, or something strikes us funny. So starting with that modest gift, I think there are tricks of the trade and approaches that can help people be funnier than they otherwise would be.
And trends change. Do I remember, I just read the book that Sid Caesar wrote. It was always assumed that the fall guy would be shorter than the straight man. And since Sid Caesar, I think, is like 6'3", about your height, they could never find a straight man who would be taller than Caesar until Carl Reiner came along.
That's an interesting point. Yes, Sid is a very athletic fellow. He never seemed a little and helpless, as the comic and many comedy teams did. But one of the many fascinating things about comedy is there are really no rules to it. There are generalities that apply to many situations, but there always seem exceptions.
Just in the last couple of minutes, I'm taking way more time than I should with you because I get the feeling you could be turning out maybe 3 or 4 books.
Actually, with my left hand, I'm writing a book at the moment. But go right ahead.
I want to talk about your old gang, Louis Nine, Tom Poston.
Yes, well, as you may have seen, if you've gotten all the way through More Funny People, there's a chapter in it called That Old Gang of Mine. And I wish I'd had more space. I should have written a separate book about the guys, but I did write a few paragraphs about each one. And I think they were the funniest comedy team in the history of television comedy, if only because they had all the others outnumbered. There were clever people. I mean, Art Carney was brilliant with Jackie Gleason and Carl Reiner and Howie Morris and Imogene and Nana Febre were very good indeed with Sid. But our guys have just gone on to tremendous success. Louis Nye and Don Knotts and Tom Poston and
How about
Pat Harrington, all of them. They're all doing very well today and deservedly so. They're wonderfully funny.
How about the Silly Center that you talked about with Louis?
Yes. In some other context, I had mentioned that I prefer, all of the things being equal, I prefer comedians with a silly center. People who have that, as I perceive it, are Woody Allen and Jonathan Winters and Robin Williams and Louis Nye, people of that sort, Dom DeLuise, John Biner. It's nothing you can be scientific about. You have to sort of sense it. But they just have a sort of an aura of silliness in a way that, say, Bob Hope does not or a Danny Thomas does not. Many other very gifted. In fact, Jack Benny did not have that. So the other comedians, it's interesting, the comedians without the silly center sometimes are even more popular. But my personal tastes go in the other direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a wonderful book. I'm just fascinated by comedy. And they say whenever you try to analyze a joke, it's immediately not funny. But you have managed to look and study the comedians without ruining a person's enjoyment by analytically studying them.
So thank you. Yeah, and I give so many examples of the humor of the people I write about, so they get laughs for me, in a sense, in the book, anyway.
Mm-hmm. Steve Allen, it's always a pleasure, and I do thank you, and I don't have to wish you luck with the book. I know it's going to be a great seller. It's very enjoyable.
Thank you so much, Ken. After all your help, I'm sure it'll do very well in the Bloomington area. Nice to talk to you and your listeners.